Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you want to go to rugby heaven? Let's go back to 1987 with Squidge, with Squidge. Let's go back to 87 with Squidge.
Hello and welcome to the Squidge Rugby World Cup retrospective. The rugby that is also rugby. I think I've now made it to almost all the way through this run of this series of the podcast without getting the title of the podcast wrong. But I can't say anything else. That's my trade-off.
You've gotten a lot better at the whole knowing the name of your own podcast thing.
Yeah,
so a lot of credit where it's due.
It's been a real struggle, frankly. I'm joined as ever by Mr. Will Owen. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
I'm all right. And joining us from Linebreak Rugby and the Dummy Runner, which is great and everyone should follow on Twitter, we are once again joined by Adam Jenkins. How are we doing?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm all right. Very relaxed after being basically serenaded by Bill McLaren for an entire 80 minutes, which is probably one of the best experiences you can have in rugby.
Yeah. So how was we'll start smaller. How was the jump back to 1987 for you? How was that experiencing? Actually, have you watched much from this period in the past yourself?
I mean, mostly we would have to be sort of old Wales games and things like that. So sort of used to the general style of rugby of the time, which is generally just throw the ball or kick it in just sort of any sort of general direction and hope something comes off. But yeah, seeing it with sort of two teams that I'm not really used to from the era. Mm. Yeah, it was interesting.
And obviously, big difference from modern rugby and even from, from 2011, which we looked at before, which was 10 years past and still seems like a long distance away. This is a whole level era, a whole different thing. It feels like a different game a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a few sort of things that stuck out to me straight away was the amount of kicking and not necessarily territorial kicking that you'd see now, but just the willingness to put it on the ball option for an attack or to try and keep it in play or something. There was a lot of footballing I noticed. Especially I'll get onto a bit, but a bit of footballing out of touch between one of the Scotland players on the Romanian player, but
very good. Yeah,
yeah.
We will come on to that. That's a very important point. Adam, I was wanting to pick up on, so last time you were on this podcast, we spoke a lot about rugby's most handsome man, Blaine Scully. Mm-hmm. And you, in a very Beetlejuice sort of way, managed to will him onto the next episode of the podcast that was about the USA. So I was just wondering if you had any plans to do similar magical things this time, if there was a particular player that you really wanted to hype up who will just magically appear on our podcast, or indeed if you want to talk about Blaine Scully more.
I got to be honest, because I was, the result of the match is well known beforehand because it's happened in the past, but I did find myself rooting for Romania as the underdogs, and I fell in love with their fullback. He just got involved with everything. And if you can manage to get the fullback from the Romania squad of 1987 on this podcast, I will be extremely impressed.
We'll do our utmost. I mean, Blaine Scully actually listened to that episode the three of us did together, didn't he?
Yeah.
Robbie, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. He messaged me saying, "I'm really enjoying the podcast," which put a huge level of pressure on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially to say, Robbie, you're very well established and always have been. And I was very, very new to this at that stage. So that completely freaked me the fuck out. And Adam, of course, you as well, you have met Blaine Scully before, which you have over the two of us. And I'm eternally jealous of that. But Yeah, it was an immense feeling of like fish out of water, thinking, oh my God, Blaine Scully's heard us all have a chat about like Vampire Weekend.
the worst thing, it was obviously lovely to know that he listened to the podcast, but at the same time, thinking, oh God, what the hell does he think of me after that? Like, yeah. He's obviously been extremely polite about it and just said that he thought the podcast was great and that he wanted to be on it and things like that. But in the back of his mind, what he must have thought...
I hope they don't get those two guests on again. That brother and that other Welsh guy. Very lovely man, Blaine Scully.
We'll have exactly the same experience with Vasily Lyon. You know, chase him in exactly the same way. I can't wait.
Yeah, but instead of talking about how handsome he is, you're just going to be, oh, what a weapon Vasil Ion is. The Romanian fullback that you were referring to, of course, Adam.
Yes, yeah.
At one point, Vasil Ion joins a ruck. He's in a ruck, and Bill McLaren loses his shit inside of it.
What I loved is, like, you know, we're calling him Vasil Ion, but in Bill McLaren's lovely, like, really rolled Scottish accent, he calls him Ian half the time.
Yeah. I just love how many moments in this match produced sort of classic Bill McLaren moments. Oh. You know, you had like you mentioned with Ion with the what is he doing there, and you had a demented ferret at one
demented
point.
Demented ferret, I have written down. Yeah, and yeah. Matt Duncan running like a demented ferret. Just Bill McLaren comes up with so many moments, and what's great is, like, this isn't a famous game. This isn't a game that, unless in this context, people are going to look back on. And the fact that he still comes up with that many great moments is just incredible.
He is the gold standard to which everyone who's ever covered rugby since is chasing.
Mm.
He is. Yeah. All of us are just walking in Bill McLaren's footsteps and trying to do something worthy of the art form he created with every word he spoke.
Yeah.
It's just, as you said at the start, Adam, it's like being serenaded. It's everything he says is wonderful, and he's so warm, and he seems to just love the game so much, no matter what the match he's covering is, no matter how it's going, no matter the teams. And it's so impossible not to get caught up in.
Mm.
And this was one of the most I've enjoyed any game in this World Cup. I don't know if it's one of the best, but Bill McLaren was commentating.
Yeah, yeah. So my favourite Bill McLaren moment in this match was, there was a woman in the crowd just wearing a shirt that said Romania okay on it, and Bill McLaren on the comments says Romania okay. Well, maybe if they scored another 25 points, there would be.
That's my favourite Radiohead album.
Nice. Nice. Had to have a Radiohead reference in here somewhere.
Yeah. I've been trying to force
Padovani listening. We've had Blaine Scully. We want Ion. We want Padovani next. We've got to keep the Radiohead references up.
I've been, as much as Robbie talks about films on this podcast, I've been trying to force Radiohead references into like as many episodes as I can of this podcast, and generally unsuccessful. So you don't know how pissed off I am that you beat me to that one, Robbie.
I haven't mentioned films that much lately, but I do want to point out that Napoleon Dynamite was playing on the wing for Romania in this game. So, their number 14, Adrian Pilotsky, looks an awful lot like Napoleon Dynamite.
Okay,
He's a kind of like very tall winger with a kind of like protruding jaw and the kind of same curly hair. And we never got a close-up of him, so I can't be proven wrong that he doesn't look anything like John Hader. But in my mind, they just had Napoleon Dynamite on the wing, and that's why he was so quiet. He was off getting the rest of his teammates to vote for Pedro.
I mean, it's a hell of a back three. To very quickly segue onto the Romanian team, having Napoleon Dynamite alongside our friend Vasil Ion and our enemy Marcel Toada, the, of course, mass adulterer of the Romanian team.
Who was kind of, at the time, very famous in Romania for basically being a bit of a playboy. Sorry, I feel like I cut you off.
No, it was just comparisons between sort of like you say, Bill McLaren in 87 and a sort of modern game. I suppose if we want to draw comparisons, that it's something I've been thinking, like, probably more than the actual game itself, to be honest. But the one of the main things that stood out to me is the fact that, you know, it's the first World Cup, it's very sort of new and people aren't really sure what it's going to be, but there was still, you still only have that one commentator.
Yeah.
And it's Bill McLaren watching the game, and he's talking to you who's watching it.
Yeah.
He's not talking to an expert or a co-commentator or anything like that. He's just relaying what he sees and what he loves about the game back to the viewer. Yes. And that's something that we don't really get in the modern game. We have like these kind of dramatic, almost like poetic commentators still, like your Andrew Cotter's, Miles Harrison's, Eddie Butler's, things like that, who I think I'd love to just see one game, like a decent sort of game, like a rugby championship or a Six Nations game, where it's just them by themselves relaying the game back to the viewer rather than going for colour commentary, taking a break to listen to an expert, that kind of thing.
I think it's a really important distinction to make, because on most of the other games in the 1987 tournament, there have been multiple commentators. But I think with Bill McLaren, he's just so brilliant on his own that he fills the air with genuine, meaningful conversation. And you like, it took me until about 30 minutes into the game to realise he was on his own, because the air was so filled with just joy and just the, like, it didn't, he didn't need somebody else. Like, he was having a conversation, as you rightly put it, Adam. Like, he's having a conversation with a viewer.
It's something that Jamie Lyle touched on when we had him on this, this podcast to talk about Scotland as well. That Bill McLaren really understands the importance of silence. Like, when he leaves a silence, it's largely deliberate. It allows you to soak something in or reflect on something or to see something. And he only speaks when he has something he wants to talk about, as you say, he wants to relay to you, as Adam said. And that... that is a large part of why he's so special. It wasn't just his voice and his turn of phrase and his warmth and enthusiasm. It's the fact that he understood the kind of craft of commentary as anyone else. You know, there are plenty of commentators now who have the craft right down, are excellent. But Bill McLaren took every possible box you could ever want from a commentator. And he was just uniformly wonderful.
And that's it. Like, there's a lot of times we've taken the piss out of commentators on this tournament. And, like... Bill McLaren probably says as many dumb things as any other commentator does, but he says them with such like a joy and a sense of irony and so much like fun and passion behind them, as you say. And like the fact that like he knows everything about all the Romanians and that he genuinely has a love for all of these players that he may or may not have seen play before. And not even just the players, like the coaches, the water boys, like the subs. The groundsmen, like he was talking about the grounds people and like what a great job they've done. And I'm pretty sure he mentioned them by name at some point.
Yeah, I think he just loved everything around rugby.
Christ.
As you know, I think I mentioned the story the last game he commentated on. There's a clip from a documentary on him of his wife during a week beforehand when Scotland playing against Tonga or someone. And his wife would just have flashcards of all the Tongan players so he could learn their faces. So that he knew them all as well as he knew the Scotland team. And he'd give them, you know, he'd say the name and give a fact or something about them, just so that he knew the players. And again, that all comes across. Like, he knows and seems to care about this Romanian team.
Yeah, yeah. With the point of Bill McLaren talking about Romania, I'm just going to play you arguably my favourite clip of commentary from this game.
But the pass, Pilotski said, "Oi son, that was a poor pass." In Romania.
I love how he goes, like, you know, full borders with, "Hey son, that was a poor pass." And then the pause is brilliant for us in Romanian. It's genuinely like comic genius on the comms by having a conversation with himself and just monologuing and not knowing if anyone finds that funny.
Should we just make the entire podcast about Bill McLaren?
Yes. Yes, I'm happy to just brown nose Bill McLaren for an hour and a half.
So, to move back to, as we mentioned, the Romanian team.
Yes.
This is an interesting game because the last time these two teams have played in 1984, Romania had won 28-22. So, there was actually something on this. And Romania had gone into the tournament, as we mentioned on the first episode of them, as a really strong underdog, as probably the strongest underdog team in the tournament. They'd beaten Italy earlier that year. They'd beaten Scotland a few years earlier. They'd beaten Wales a few years earlier. They'd beaten France 5 years before this.
Coming off the win against Zimbabwe, of course, earlier in the tournament. Yeah. So they're on a winning run.
So, and they need, if they won this game against Scotland, they could make the quarterfinals. They could have made the knockouts ahead of them. So there was a lot on this game. And yet when you look at it, when you look back on it with kind of the guise of history of knowing where these two teams kind of paths diverge, this is the end. This World Cup very much marks the end of a kind of golden era of Romanian rugby that they got back to a little bit in the noughties, but not really since. Not really on the scale where they're beating the Six Nations teams regularly. In a way that if that happened now, they might be in the conversation to be added to the as a seventh nation. Sure. They were better at the time comparatively than Georgia are now. They're better than Italy are now, comparatively.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mention all that, because, like, with... As you say, this was kind of almost the golden age of Romanian rugby. As you say, they were...
The kind of tail end of it.
That's it. They were competitive with the other sort of six nations as we know them. Mm. And certainly, as you say, better than Italy were at this stage. And so we've looked before at a couple of the Romanian players. And we did, of course, touch before on the fact that 2 years after this World Cup, Cristian Raducanu, their number eight, defected from Romania to Scotland.
Mm.
So it makes you wonder if getting absolutely hammered by Scotland, 6 minutes into the game, he was there blowing on his knees, just going like... I'd rather be one of them. I'd rather live there.
He heard Bill McLaren's commentary when watching it back, Gary Lambert style, and just went, I want to be there. I want to be close to that guy. I want to see if everyone's like him. So to pick up on the Romanian team then, they make a handful of changes to their previous outing, their previous time up against France. So we see Adrian Lungu switches from the wing into centre. And we have a couple of changes in the pack, but the Constantine brothers remain in, who are quieter now than they have been in the previous two games.
Thank God.
But boy, Adam, the Constantine brothers in the second rows are the biggest shithouses in 1987 rugby, which is saying even more than it is today.
I have written down the bottom of my page here, mate, Constantine is a shit. I'm not sure which one I'm referring to, but literally all those two do is cheat. Like, they don't do anything legal in the whole tournament, including scoring tries.
Yeah, and then out of nowhere score a 50-metre try that they run in division.
But, like, whilst they're running it in, they knock a few people out along the way and, you know, shoot a few people in the stands and so on.
I wonder if the rise of TMOing has led to the downfall of Romanian rugby. So there's a handful of changes to Romania, but it's a pretty strong team. This is pretty much seen as the strongest team they could have put out. Mika Pasharev continued as captain. I have no idea why.
Yeah, I mean, he played fairly well in one of the previous games, didn't he? He was kind of one of the standout players, I think. I don't know, I might have made that up. It's hard to remember. But I guess, who else do they have that could be captain? Looking at their team, but I don't know. Yeah, do we want to look at Scotland?
Yeah, so Scotland, again, their last game was against Zimbabwe, and they make a few changes on that, bringing back in a few of the first-choice players, such as Roy Laidlaw. But actually, it's largely the same team. They still have the likes of that back row of Ian Paxton, Finlay Calder, John Jeffrey, Derek White, the big shithouse. But at tight head, they do bring in the other change, Norrie Rowan, who was 37 and winning his ninth cap, which he won over a very long kind of career of, he won 13 caps, over about 13 years, and he'd kind of get drafted in every so often.
It feels very much like a Wayne Pivac selection, that.
Yes. So it's funny you mentioned the Cristian Raducanu. So Norrie Rowan is an interesting figure in, and a very key figure in Cristian Raducanu's life, right?
No.
So Cristian Raducanu, as we mentioned, Romania was in a real political shit state at the time. Like, we've covered it in previous episodes.
Yes.
And he effectively wanted to run away. He was, you know, scared for his own life, largely. And Rowan, as a job, used to excavate the Edinburgh vaults, the tunnels underneath the city. Right?
What?
Which, I mean, you compare that to nowadays, where players are just professional rugby players. The fact they had a tight head who excavates hidden tunnels under the city.
Jesus!
So that was what he did for a living, right?
It makes me wonder who was doing that while he was at the World Cup.
Yeah. It's hard to get someone to cover short term, that, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
It's hard to just draft someone in. So, when Cristian Raducanu first defected to Scotland, first moved to Scotland, right? In 1989, Romania sent members of secret police after him when he was seeking asylum in order to find him and bring him back home. And Norrie Rowan, having access to all these secret tunnels under Edinburgh, hid him in one for a
week. No! You are fucking kidding me. So
why are we talking about, why are we talking about rugby and not this right now?
So these two played a rugby match against each other, not knowing that one day they would be allies in like a life or death situation.
Yep, they were both teammates at Boroughmuir RFC, and then when Raducanu was clearly like, I've just found out the Romanian secret police are coming out to catch me and bring me back to a corrupt nation. Nori Rowan was just like, hey, you know, I know exactly how to solve this one. And that led him down into a tunnel underneath Edinburgh.
It's incredible because, like, you hear about, like, say, James Davis was just signing for the Scarlets. You know, he stayed with his brother Jonathan for a little bit in his flat or whatever. You hear stories like that where, you know, Jeff Hastler and Tyler Ardron stayed together in their time at the Ospreys and lived together for a little while. Instead, here you got Nori Rowan just saying, don't worry, pal. I know that you're about to get nuked, but I've got a cave for you if you want it.
Rowan then later ran for the Scottish Parliament elections in 1999.
Oh my God.
And...
You've got at least one vote.
Yeah, he now runs a number of pubs and bars in Edinburgh.
Oh, nice. If ever we do a pod social up there, we know exactly where to go.
So he runs the Tron Tavern, which apparently...
Is that the cave or the pub?
I think it's probably both. So it's apparently a tradition that visiting players after internationals go and visit that after playing Scotland and Murrayfield.
Hiya, son. Do you want a pint of cave water?
Yeah. I wonder if Rowan started that rumour himself.
Yeah.
I wonder if he might be the demented mole that Bill McLaren...
He's always digging his Nori Rowan.
Either that or the demented mole is one of his many pubs.
Yeah.
was it even a sanctioned job? To dig tunnels under Edinburgh.
He just did it. He just fancied a day out.
It was either a sanctioned job or a sanctioned hobby. It was one or the other.
But like, we've been round the Edinburgh vaults.
We have, yeah.
They were excavated by Nori Rowan, the Scotland International tie-head prop.
One thing I also enjoy is, so according to Christian Raducanu's Wikipedia page, his father is a high-ranking member of the Romanian military who was aware of all of this and the turmoil it might result in. He advised that he takes this trip to Scotland. So was Christian Raducanu's father then having to stay zip about the fact that the Romanian military were then after his own son and having to just be secretly, like, in on it and be like, oh yeah, let's go catch this bastard Raducanu, who I have no idea who he is, of no relation to me.
Genuinely a great spy movie in this.
There is.
Why hasn't this been made starring probably Benedict Cumberbatch as Christian Raducanu?
And Alan Jacobson as Nori Rowan.
I think this would be great. I think this could be made.
This could be your masterpiece, Robbie.
This is it. This is where the channel is ahead.
Yeah.
It's never mind Invictus 2, the Sia Khaleesi story. The rugby movie that really needs to be made is Christian Raducanu and his defection from Romania to Scotland.
And look, when the rugby scenes are acted out, I think we need to get all of the previous guests of this podcast into act them, because it would be a similar standard to 1987.
Except Blaine Scully.
Blaine Scully just charging through all of us.
Yeah, I mean, sure. He can play John Kermit. That's fine.
So I'm playing in a Pride in Touch tournament run by former guest on the podcast, Nick Heath, at the end of June. And they've just mentioned Katie Daly McLean's playing in it. So that's going to be exciting.
Yeah, nice knowing you.
But Nick suggested to me when I was first talking about me going and playing in it, he suggested, oh, why don't you try and get a team and try and get a team together? So I had a quick flick through my phone book and just see whose number that I've got. He's a good rugby player. And I noticed, like, I was scrolling through it. It's mostly like people I was at uni with and people who've never heard of rugby before.
I was going to say, it says a lot that you messaged me first, asking if I wanted to play. And just like, no, I mean, terrible rugby player, sure.
But then I get to, like, Brian Habana and I kind of go like, oh, right, yeah, okay, that's kind of... I mean, I doubt he's going to come over for a touch tournament.
Sure.
Really stood out. It was a fun, delightful moment to be scrolling through people I went to uni with, thinking, could they play rugby? Would they come out? And then just see, like, oh, there's former World Player of the Year and the top try scorer in the Rugby World Cup of all time. Right, okay.
Have you ever, like, wondered whether you're just one day just going to, like, drunkenly call him?
I should do it, shouldn't I? I'm surprised I haven't yet.
Yeah, just booty call, you know.
Yeah, just say hi to Brian, my close friend.
Yeah,
who I've spoken to 3 times. That was a boast. So, should we move on to the game now that we've covered the teams and the remarkable spy stories contained within?
Yeah, I think we should certainly start looking at the pre-match.
Ooh.
Because there was a lot of stuff going on pre-match. I mean, because this match was played in the Scottish flavours of Dunedin, as Bill McLaren so joyfully referred to it as. And I'll tell you what, this stadium loved Scotland.
So Bill McLaren mentions it. They said they've got an incredible 250 to 300 Scotland fans have travelled over.
Yeah.
Which you compare that to the thousands who travelled over these days at World Cup, it does show just how much the tournament's changed and grown.
Sure, yeah. But the good thing about this coverage is that they show the pitch and then they actually show us the Scottish dressing room as they're getting ready. And they show the referee knocking on the door saying, you know, come out now, whatever. Bill McLaren says on the commentary, lots of shouting from the Scottish dressing room. I don't know what it did to the Romanians, but it scared the life out of me.
And then we hear some of it as well as the referee knocks on the dressing room door. And they all sort of scream, yes! So it's finally time to go and batter some Romanians.
It's something that I've noticed that hasn't been improved on since 1987 is the camera trying to get the moment where the referee or the touch judge opens the door into the changing room and the players come out. They either bump up against something or the team is not ready yet and they have to close the door again quickly. Or the team's taking a while to come out and the camera just stood there and the touch judge is just waiting. It never ever works, and I wonder why they still bother sometimes.
I'll tell you, the only time I think they've ever got it right was Sia Khaleesi leaving the dressing room for the World Cup final.
It's just as well, isn't it?
They nailed the timing on that, and they've never got it either side. It's like they peaked at the big occasion and then can't do it at the, you know, it's that kind of, could he do it on a wet Sunday afternoon in Sale? No, the camera directors can't do it. They can only do it for the World Cup final.
Of course, as we see these cheerleaders dancing to music, they evidently can't hear because the camera is not picking it up. We then see the Scotland team running out and we've seen them coming out the dressing room, this big build-up of, oh, it's finally here. Scotland are coming out. And you see them running out and actually Romania are just coming out too at the same time. Just nobody's like noticed them as well. So you just got like, wait, Romania are coming too? To pipes? Like they're playing Scotland the Brave as both teams are running out.
You think this is the moment Christian Radicalu defected in his head?
Fuck this, so I want the attention.
I just want some attention, I want people to look at me.
I just have written down at one point, guys, Romania are here too.
Yeah. Adam, can I ask you about the anthems and your impression of watching these anthems here?
The circle aspect shocked me.
Yeah.
Shocked and confused me. I don't know why that, like, something went, it sent off an alarm in my brain that there's not a line, there's a circle, and that's wrong. But it just did. And I got to be honest, throughout the anthems, probably for the first 10 minutes of the match, I was only thinking about Romania's jersey, especially with the sleeves rolled up, because that was a football kit. That wasn't. But it's beautiful. What an excellent kit that is.
It's really nice. I feel like we haven't paid enough attention to the jerseys in general on this kind of series.
Because I feel like, sort of, you know, 80s is still sort of in that time in rugby, at least, where it's just block colours and a collar. And it's not really until sort of the 90s where you start to get a bit more sort of flair on some of the kits. But the Romanian with the bright yellow, almost neon yellow.
Yeah.
And the Adidas stripes. It was just, it's just perfect.
Yeah, the kind of fade on, no, not the fade, the kind of like stencil lining on the numbers on the back.
Yes, yeah. And like the old Romanian logo is just looks so great on those jerseys as well. So yeah, once I'd got over the circle shock, that's pretty much all I was focusing on.
And so nothing to do with rugby.
why would it be?
A bit like how the Wallabies recently have changed the shade of their jersey in order for it to stand out more, making it kind of very much gold but to an orangey degree rather than yellow. This the shade and the brightness of that yellow would never be confused with Australia or with any other team. It's extremely Romanian, that really bright kind of like almost acrylic, like almost like sickly yellow shade that they used.
Yeah, it's glorious, magnificent.
It really is.
With these anthems, then, so to accommodate for the amount of limelight that was on Scotland, they give Romania two extra verses in the national anthem, which they just neglect and just stop singing along and just like, come on, can we actually get on with the kickoff now? And then, of course, they've already played Scotland the Brave as the teams are running out. So as they start to play it again, instead of singing along, Scotland do a team talk during the anthem.
So they all huddle up, and then in the middle, we have Colin Deans, the captain, who is also the shortest player in the team.
Yes.
Right. And so they're all looking down at Colin Deans quite intimidatingly because, you know, like Derek White can't help but be scary. Finlay Calder can't help but be scary.
Sure.
So they're all looking down at Colin Deans. And it all looks a bit like they've ganged up to start on him in a West Side Story kind of way. Like, it looks like they're all trying to intimidate the tiny kid who's now desperately trying to talk his way out.
They're all about to push him, and he's there just going, I'll kill all of you! Kill all your families! I don't know why he's Irish now.
It looks incredibly, like a fight scene from West Side, from like the original 50s West Side Story.
So, what he says in his team talk is, let's do it for those guys in the tartan over there. They've come a long way for this. Let's show them what to do. Like, they have to then come on the pitch afterwards and do an exact replica.
This is a great idea. What if, after each game, fans had to come on and exactly recreate it?
I've watched a lot of Taskmaster on television, the Channel 4 programme, and there was one task they did where it was have the most fun, like, as a team, like, have the most fun, and then it's exactly recreate your fun. The real task. And like, obviously when you ask comedians to have the most fun, they try and do something extremely extravagant or extremely ambitious. And so making them exactly recreate that was just generally very funny. So I think it's kind of the opposite effect, having 80s rugby players try and recreate, like, oh, is this the point where I drop the ball? Or is this the point where I run over the touchline?
I'd love... Let's do it for those guys in tartan over there to become the official motto of the Scottish Rugby Union.
At Murrayfield, they never know which one you're talking to.
It's the beauty of it. It encompasses all fans.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So looking at the game, and as we get to kickoff, I was probably into about 10 minutes into this game, when I realised, and I want to know both of your perspectives on this, I've never seen a rugby game that feels more like a Monty Python sketch than this one. From the very first kickoff, which I found hilarious.
The first minute of this game is so eventful.
Yeah, right? The first four passages of play involve someone getting injured.
So, right from the kickoff, Scotland regather the kickoff. They string together five really beautiful offloads.
I mean, given that Romania just decided to not mark that half of the pitch.
That's what's really funny. That made me laugh out loud. Was Scotland, Romania were all probably stood about their own 22. They didn't know how to stand for a kickoff. And then Scotland just go, all right, we'll just kick it 10 metres then. And like, just like, you fucking fools.
And it wasn't even
just
like a
stand there.
When you think of like a modern sort of what you would, like in NFL terms, like an onside kick where you try and just get it to 10 metres and then regather. It's either, you know, a grubber along the ground, or you put it really high so you have time to get your team in position to get them up in the air and to regather. This was just like a standard short kickoff that if any Romanians were in the right position, could have taken easily before the Scottish players had got even 5 meters past the halfway line.
Like, any Romanian in a 15-meter radius would have at least challenged for the ball. But I just found it so funny that, as you say, he just chips it.
Yeah.
I've just watched it back and you're completely right. I didn't even pay attention. The closest Romanian is 15 meters away. And that's by the time he regathers it. Like, never mind when the kick goes up. They've just left about 30 meters of the pitch undefended completely.
Like, it looks like it has to be a double bluff. And Scotland just kind of just go, oh, if you're not going to mark it, we'll just kick it there. It's that simple.
And so it then makes sense why they can so easily beat the Romanians. Because they then string together a passage. They called back for forward pass in the end. But it would have been a really glorious try with them all uploading and taking everything. But one of them's called as a slight forward pass. But, like, they've only got to draw two players and they're in. Because no one has stood anywhere nearby.
And then, yeah, the forward pass is given for what would have been one of the funniest tries in the World Cup. If they had scored that try 5 seconds into the game, just because Romania just were asleep and didn't know how to play rugby, it would have been really, really great. Then the forward pass is given, and in the preamble to the game, there was a lot of build-up given towards Scott Hastings in the 12 jersey. And I was looking forward to seeing Scott Hastings play, actually, because I've never really seen him play, other than maybe a few highlights and stuff, but I've never really seen him play a full match. And you
so
know,
we missed that as well, yeah. Like, he came to the World Cup as part of the squad, then pulled his hamstring in the lead-in, and this was his first game. We didn't mention that in the Scotland team. So he was brought in for the first game of the tournament here.
Yeah, and yeah, like, Scott Hastings was always renowned as kind of quite a big lad who can handle the ball quite well. And given the standard of 12s we've seen in this tournament so far, I was looking forward to seeing him, particularly linking up with his brother Gavin, who has a fantastic game that we'll come on to. But 1 minute into the game, not even, his hamstring goes from underneath him. And it's like, normally that would be funny, but I just struggled to laugh at it this time round.
Yeah, I mean, you feel for him a bit, don't you? Finally coming into the World Cup, finally having...
On the other side of the world.
Yeah, travel, having been literally hamstrung the entire tournament by this injury. And then it just giving way seconds into the game, the first tackle he takes, and it's gone.
Hamstring injuries are the worst, man. Like, you can just go running and just pull up with it, and it's horribly painful. And, like... It's not like you've broken your leg. You've just tweaked your hamstring. Like, when you talk to people about it, you know, like, it's a horrible injury to have. I really, really felt from going off, literally chasing that kickoff, he got injured, which must have been awful. It, like, him making it through, if there was a warm-up, and then to go out in the first 5 seconds of the game is awful.
You know, thankfully he does go on to play in a World Cup after this. Thankfully he does go on to play in future World Cups. But you do feel, you can't help but feel for him, his chance of playing this inaugural tournament completely taken away from him.
Yeah.
Doesn't go on to recover in time to play for the quarterfinal. This is his tournament over and done with. He gets 1 minute of game time, which must be a complete low in terms of players who played in the World Cup and played the fewest minutes, right? Because like we had on the previous
one. In New Zealand as well.
Joe Simpson played something like 8 minutes in that World Cup. Is that this must be the lowest anyone's managed? He managed about 50 seconds before going off injured.
Got to be the biggest flight time to minutes played ratio.
Yes.
On the topic of injuries, I don't know whether either of you had this sort of like noted down for later on, but just while I'm thinking of it, a bit later on in the match, Bill McLaren was talking about the concussion protocol of the 80s, which I thought was, I mean, both sort of. in a way, I was like, oh, great. They had an awareness of concussion. And that if you, I mean, it was only 3 weeks at the time they were saying the concussion protocol. Like if you're confirmed to have a concussion, you have to take a break of 3 weeks and then you can just get back to it. Hmm. But at the same, you know, you sort of think, oh, great. That's at least something. But then, I got thinking, well, a lot of the argument that people come out with the game's gone soft kind of people and the whole idea about rugby players, especially like in the early 2000s, a lot of the players now sort of coming out with concussion issues, saying that, oh, we couldn't have known, or people trying to defend it, saying they couldn't have known at the time how it's going to affect them. Mm. So to hear that in 1987, that concussion protocols were in effect, and how little we've learned since then, or been willing to learn and change, is made me quite sad, really.
Yeah.
And there's been points in this World Cup where players have taken a shot to the head and look clearly concussed and would never be allowed to play. Well, you say never allowed to play on these days, but the Tom Francis thing happened in the Six Nations. And then just played on and played the rest of that game. But and similar for all manner of injuries as well, where players have just been forced to play on through injuries.
Yeah.
And it happens here with this, you know, there isn't a replacement warming up for Hastings. So they have to play two passages of play before they eventually get someone on. But all this feeds into, I think there was a awareness of concussions were a thing, but it feels a bit like they just weren't taken seriously, you know? Or it was seen as only if you really don't know where you are and you've kind of lost your memory for a few minutes, it can affect you.
Yeah.
And it does, as you say, make it even more alarming that we haven't learned from this.
Yeah.
You know, or it took rugby so long to learn from it. It's only really started to happen in the last 5 years, you know, 20 plus years on, 40 years on from this World Cup almost, that we start to actually learn the lessons that were evident then, that we could have had things like this in place by the time the game turned professional in 1995, you know, things 100%. Like the HIA and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you say, it hadn't even occurred to me that they have a protocol, and I'm glad they did.
Yeah, it's genuinely more than I expected, and him saying the 3 weeks off thing, I was genuinely half expecting, like, if they had a protocol, it's just to be, see how you feel the next day, and then maybe play the next game, you know?
Yeah, and I think as the protocol, the kind of, there wasn't like a HIA process that they had to go through and pass at the time. I think the doctor literally looked and went like, yeah, you can still walk.
Yeah,
and that was it.
Or just ask, how are you? And they'd go, yeah, I'm fine. And that was it.
And because also it was an era when forwards in particular really traded on just being hard. And so you would pretend to try and hide things far more.
Of course, yeah.
Rather than necessarily like putting your team first, never mind your own health long term.
Yeah.
And your pride.
100%, 100%. I think it's a very important point.
So, Scotland have to set a scrum and Finlay Calder goes onto the wing because they're down a player.
I didn't clock this.
Yep. Bill McLaren pulls up. Finlay Calder goes to play on the wing for a passage whilst they're waiting for someone to come on.
I saw that Sir Alan Tait goes down injured on sort of the second passage of play. Mm. And it just feels like, is this Wales in 2015? Both centres getting injured in the first minute. Like,
we can bring Lloyd Williams on.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Adam, you can sell him some towels.
Yeah.
Did you tell that story in the podcast before?
I honestly can't remember, but the selling of the towels happened before the World Cup, so I like to think they were magic.
Do you want to tell that story now, Adam?
It's not particularly exciting.
No. That's the point. We don't want exciting stories.
I love it. I think it's very exciting. It's just, and I think about it all the time.
I used to work for a company that made custom like embroidered clothes and sometimes towels. My boss was away for a week. I had a bit more sort of free rein with what customers I took on and didn't. Well, I thought I did, but. Yeah, got a phone call from Lloyd Williams. He needed some towels for the boys. They were all getting presents for each other before before going off to their World Cup camps in 2015. Mm. Got that sorted for him within a week. And like I said, I like to think those were like gold embroidered with the initials of all the different players.
It's very cool.
Which is why I like to think they were magic. but only for Lloyd Williams, because it didn't work for anyone else. It severely injured everyone else on the team. But
turn Lloyd Williams into the best winger in the world.
Exactly. Yeah. I like to think that he had a particularly wet left foot, and he was drying it really, really thoroughly before the match. And yeah.
Wait a second. This gives me an idea.
I do love that story. And I've heard this secondhand via Robbie before, but to hear it from the source is a truly magical story. And look, what's really important is that you've just willed Lloyd Williams into the podcast. So our next episode will be with Lloyd Williams talking specifically about towels and nothing else.
If that happens, I would be. I think that would be like the full circle of my life complete. Sell Lloyd Williams towels and then hear Lloyd Williams talk about towels. That would be it for me.
I'd love it if we got Lloyd Williams and asked about nothing but the towels. Not his what is it now, like 12-year career as an international.
Yeah.
Not him creating one of the most important moments in rugby history.
Yeah, not his 40-odd Wales caps. Like, no. And like, I think he's up to about 50,000 Cardiff caps now.
He did ask for 1 point green and gold towels, and I'd say, Lloyd, you're not South Africa, you're Wales.
We've got Australia in our pool, Lloyd.
How did he take it?
Very well. He's a lovely man. From, you know, from the point of view of someone selling him towels, I think he was a lovely person. I can't speak for any other interaction that anyone may have had for him, but. Sure. In that particular scenario, if you ever find yourself in a position where you're selling Lloyd Williams towels,
it's a good tip.
You'll be in for a treat.
Okay.
I mean, learn a lot about someone from how they treat like waiting staff and how they treat employees in shops and so on. And so, I think what better truer test of a rugby player than how they treat someone selling them towels?
Lloyd Williams is great at buying towels, and he can box kick off both feet. He's one of the best scrum halves Wales has ever produced, evidently. Would you say he's in the top five towel customers that you've ever dealt with?
Oh, top one.
Wow.
He was the only one I sold towels to. towels wasn't really a common thing. Like that was okay. Part of the...
So he's the bottom towel customer you've ever had.
Oh, yeah, he's simultaneously the worst person I've ever sold towels to. Absolute nightmare. Well, no, the thing is, my boss wasn't happy because I sanctioned the order with like less than a week to fulfill it, and it wasn't like one design being printed or embroidered on these towels. They were different letters, so they all had to be individually set up on these machines, and. We didn't really do towels normally, so the machines weren't designed for them. My boss, neither the manufacturing staff were happy with me.
Yeah, I think it's really cool is that nobody on this podcast has ever sold towels to somebody with less Wales caps than Lloyd Williams.
I probably never will.
Yep.
Yeah.
But surely they'd just be delighted that you're selling towels to the Welsh squad.
See, this is where it circles back to the podcast. My boss was Scottish.
Oh, okay. So,
or was he a Romanian pretending to be Scottish?
So, if he was selling towels to Henry Purgos, then it would have been a very different deal.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you think actually that infamous penalty, the Craig Joubert moment, Bernard Foley slotting it at the death, was actually entirely because? No one gave Ross Ford the towel. So he couldn't drive the ball off, so the penalty's given.
He's piecing it all together.
That explains it.
Look, one day we're going to get on to 2015 in this podcast, and we had better have our Ross Ford towel special before then, so we have all the answers.
This is such a deep rabbit hole. We're going to need Rory Noah to excavate this rabbit hole. It's so deep.
Very good analogy. I like it. We'll do the towel retrospective probably after this series, you think, Robbie?
Sure. Yeah. We need to go in depth on towels.
We need to know a lot about rugby players' views on towels. Just generally. Rugby!
Game.
yeah, game of rugby. There's the moment you were on about earlier, Adam. I would like you to go into a little more depth. You've teased it a little bit, but now is your time to shine on the great footballing collision on the sideline between Vasi Lion and Matt Duncan.
So yeah, this is when I really bought into the match. I'd gone over the circle and the jerseys, and it was a funny start to the game anyway. But the ball had sort of rolled out into touch, and Romanian fullback Ion went to clear it. Get rid of it, so Scotland couldn't do anything with it. Booted it out into the stands while it was already out. Matt Duncan wasn't pleased with this turn of events, and I think Bill McLaren went kind of easy on him in terms of it. Kind of the way he described it was that Duncan went in to try and just trap the ball with his foot, basically, and try and stop it from being booted out into the stands. What really happened is that he went like studs up into Ion's ankle with like a flying slide tackle, which I thought was gonna like end the game for him. Like the way he went down, it was an odd moment of quite shocking violence, which I feel should have led to a fight, but didn't.
Yeah, disappointing lack of fight. To say you removed
what's going on? You've got the Constantine brothers. Do they just not care about their fullback? Do they just not care about Ion?
The thing is,
normally they will fight anything.
I don't think anyone was watching. It was behind the pack and everything like that. They were, you know, I almost just sort of doing shithousey fullback things, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, and I don't think anyone expected a sort of slide tackle into the ankle. So they weren't really looking for it to fight back against. I don't know. It's just, yeah.
I was led to believe Finlay Calder was always watching.
He was watching the guys in tartan on the sideline.
Oh, that's true. He has to remember who he's playing for.
Yeah.
Maybe the boys in tartan were the football team and they were showing them how to do it.
That's a good point. So they were both trying to teach each other their own methods.
So they know what to do.
Yeah.
You've cracked the code, Adam. That explains so much. I mean, we'll come on to like the standard of kicking in this game was fantastic. Like the goal kicking was brilliant.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Like there was only two missed kicks in the entire game. We'll come on to it, but Gavin Hastings broke a record. Like
let's kind of touch on this now because yeah, like Romania in the second half do the most pointless, beautiful, wonderful, incredible strike I've ever seen. Like I think it is Ion himself who nails a penalty from the halfway line, like on the angle.
Yeah.
To put Romania only 21 points behind.
I love that, like, the amount of things that change in rugby that you understand, because, like, again, nobody's trialed things yet, so how would they know them? It's not been coached. But mathematics is one thing that's just come a long way in rugby. Like, people have realised that 3 points doesn't get you that much closer.
It's incredible, isn't it? The way Romania is so reliant on kicking goals. And it seems to lull Scotland into this kind of false, close test match.
Mm.
And so despite being 20 points up, suddenly because Romania are kicking goals from everywhere, you know, to try and catch up, Scotland's not doing it in response.
Yeah. Like, oh no, if they're kicking it, we must only be 9 points ahead.
Yeah, I mean, especially because like any form of set piece is just a coin toss in this era. Yeah. It's not. It doesn't matter whose possession it is in the scrum or the lineout, because it'll be thrown or fed in, and something will happen, and then the ball will come out either one side, or in one case in Scotland's favour, like through the side and then out through another angle and then for a try. But if I was a coach at the time, apparently not bothering to coach any form of set piece whatsoever, yeah. I would just say go for as many of them as you can, because odds are you'll end up getting something out of it. Apparently you don't even have to really try. You can just hope and something will happen in those kind of set pieces, which is another thing I noticed is like the speed of setting up for set pieces. Obviously, we all know, we've all talked about like the difference in times between like scrums and how quickly they were set up back then and between now. But even the lineouts, like there's no huddle before a lineout or you know, decisions on what call you're going to make from it. You just turn up. Someone's going to throw the ball, and if it lands near you, great, you can kind of pat it back to your side. And that's where the strategy begins and ends. So there's no need to sort of have a huddle or anything like that beforehand. So yeah, it's one of those things I expect going back into sort of amateur rugby is seeing that kind of thing. But also looking at it and going, this game's been played at a pretty high level for about 100 years at this point.
Yeah.
And they still don't give a shit about two of the most important aspects of the game.
Yeah. Yes. Very true. Well, like, and it's so jarring having watched a lot of Super Rugby from the 90s back for the Eddie Jones video, which is just going on up by the time people listen to this. And indeed, as we record this.
Yes.
And comparing it to this in 1987, it's so difficult at this point in 87 to control possession. Like you can't really keep hold of the ball as a tactic because ruck's such a free-for-all.
Phase play isn't a word.
No, it isn't a thing. Like
as you pointed out before, Robbie, like the referees just blow up anything as unplayable, which then leads to a scrum, which, as you say, Adam, is a lottery, and the whole thing, like, you can't rely on phase play too well. But that said, like, maybe that's why everyone throws stupid offloads all the time.
Yeah, it's far closer to football in the way that possession can change hands very easily out of nowhere, which is something that rugby doesn't have nowadays, because you can control possession and it creates this kind of like very different kind of give and flow, wherein it's kind of, there's far more difference between attack and defence these days, I think, whereas at the time everything was quite fluid and you had to act as though you could turn from attack into defence and defence into attack at any given moment.
I like that as a mindset towards this, actually. Mm. Yeah, I like that. I think that's very accurate, the way that, like, you say it's more like football. It's more like table football, in a way. That, like, you have your, like, set way of standing, which is like, oh, if the ball comes to me, then we'll adapt. And we'll just flick it in that direction. It's kind of the way it works, right? I don't know.
Like, I wonder if it would have been possible for defences to improve as they have to this standard without first handling and general core skills improving to the point. Like, obviously, if you dropped a modern team into play 87, like, even a championship team or the most, or like a top level amateur team would be beating most of these sides. Just because of kind of the level of innovation and level of
structure,
you know, like accuracy and structure have come into the game, changed it fundamentally, and just like focus and so on, and like things have dripped down from professional rugby into amateur rugby. But not to say that like the players in the top amateur divisions are better players, but like they would beat them just because they have a better understanding of the game.
No, I 100% agree with you.
And they would approach it entirely differently in a far more advanced, thoughtful way.
Yeah,
but the more I watch this World Cup, the more I think actually it probably did need 30 years to advance to the point that we are now.
Sure.
You couldn't have just dropped one of those aspects in and everyone would have caught up.
Yeah.
But also, as I said, it was so jarring watching Super Rugby from the 90s, because suddenly teams are controlling possession and teams are running phases. And like there is an expectation of you can set up for the following phase rather than just going, well, it's going to be a scrum or a line-out immediately. Yeah.
God,
changed in 10 years.
Yeah.
Some things change around the 95 World Cup, and I suppose that starts to happen. And then Eddie Jones comes along and starts making phase play, like attacking phases into a thing that teams did deliberately.
Yes.
Rather than something that was now possible somewhere in that mid-90s. Mm. But that's still only 10 years on from this World Cup. Like, we're 10 years away from Eddie Jones creating a free phase move.
Yeah, everybody go and watch the Scridge Rugby video on Eddie Jones, which you probably have if you're listening to this. But
yeah,
I don't know if anyone listening has heard of this guy Scridge.
Robbie, would you mind just muting your microphone a second? Adam, what's your opinion on him?
He makes decent videos. A lot.
Really?
Hates Ireland, though. Absolutely hates Ireland.
He does hate Ireland. I think that some of the editing on the videos is quite good. I think sometimes some of the editing is good. I think sometimes some of the analysis is okay in patches, but it depends which of the two members of that team has done it. I think the script writing and the voiceovers and all of the stuff, the clever stuff in it that requires hard work and dedication and like a unique kind of like actual some sort of talent, I think that's all dog shit, to be honest. I don't think that's actually any good. Yeah, I just think he's just generally a little bit overrated.
He is, genuinely agree. the best thing about the Squidge Rugby project as it is that if it wasn't me, I would be ripping the piss out of that guy all the time. I mean, it's like bloody what Squidge would say here.
Yeah, and that's a
like,
really
it'll
good
be
point.
A running joke for me if like, oh, bloody Squidge would reckon this is pretty good if it wasn't literally me.
It's a good point. Do I only like Squidge Rugby because it's my brother? I've never like, really I'm thought sure, this before.
I'm sure like, I'd watch the videos and I'd be like, oh, it's still, you know, grand, but...
If I wasn't related to you, do you think I would enjoy the videos?
Probably. You'd probably every now and again go, oh, I think that was an interesting point, but would be far, far, far more down on it if we hadn't had in-depth discussions about George Ford.
Yeah, that's
before
it.
Before like... you watching that video on George Ford.
Yeah. We're I think we're probably both quite cynical when it comes to that kind of thing, so yeah, it makes sense. Probably me more so. Yeah, Squidge is fine, probably.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Right. You know, don't really watch the videos. So, podcast's pretty good, by the way, though. I've heard the
podcast's
good.
Really,
never
really
listened
good.
To it, but it's yeah. apparently it's pretty good.
Yeah, we get some great guests on.
Yeah.
Sometimes,
yeah. So we're only an hour and 5 minutes or so into this podcast, but should we talk about Alan Tate's try? The first try of the game?
Nice try. Lovely try.
Really
lovely
nice,
try.
Isn't it?
It's
especially
nice to
like
see forwards do things.
That's it. So like it starts with Parascheev, the Romanian captain, attempting a box kick, which goes straight into the man next to him's hands, and that
this
is John Jeffrey.
Immediately after, off a scrum, he takes a quick tap on Romania in a penalty and runs into his own forwards and gets penalised for accidental offside.
Yes.
So he has two dick of the day worthy moments in a row.
He does. But yeah, it goes straight into the hands of John Jeffrey. It makes a really good catch while the ball is like in flight at some pace as well. And yeah, very quickly feeds it inside to Wiley, isn't it? Who, quick hands back on the inside to Tate, who's running great line. Calder, okay, yeah. And then Wiley as well has a really quick touch on the ball.
But Calder steps like four people.
Of course he does, yeah. But yeah, it's great because like a moment of like great sort of balance and kind of reaction time to catch that ball. Then a moment of great sort of agility, as you say, followed up by a great moment of handling and then a nice line to finish it by Tate. Mm. It's just all round a very nice try.
No defence like, but it's lovely.
Oh, no, not at all. But who cares?
Yeah, I loved how much the Scottish forwards got involved with the handling aspect of the play throughout the game, not just in the first try. I think they had some of the quickest hands. But they probably had quicker hands than the backs, to be honest. They would sort of get it out of the cluster of Romanians that had surrounded the ball carrier, and then the backs would kind of do the rest. Generally, the speed with which they were just sort of passing it along was very satisfying.
Yeah, I mean, like. In some ways, I don't blame them for having quick hands when you look at what they were up to at the ruck. And so it probably leads to a level.
The ruck is something special. I mean, if anything, it's easier for the ref because no matter what penalty they call for, it's fine. There will have been a penalty.
Yeah.
And at one point, Bill McLaren says that there's a ruck penalty. And he says... And that's a penalty for going over the top or holding onto the ball or not releasing the player. And it's like, yeah, fine. It could have been any one of those three. And yeah, there's no reason for it not to be any ruck. It's just that it seems like the ref decided, right, yeah, enough time has gone now without there being a penalty. I'll just ping that guy there for that thing.
Because the referee in this game, who was Stephen Hilditch of Ireland, he... tends to blow his whistle, then wait a moment before throwing his arm in the air to indicate which side he's blown the penalty to. And you never know.
No,
you never know who he's awarding the penalty to until he's already done it.
Yeah, I quite confidently think, Romania have just gone way over the top there. None of them are on their feet. And then penalty Romania for something Scotland might have done at some point. And it's like, yeah, okay, fine, whatever. I can buy that.
Penalty Scotland, the military are after you, number eight.
At one point, Bill McLaren has a word with Derek White for something he does at a ruck. And Bill McLaren just says, Derek White, he must have done something naughty.
Yes. Yeah. It really made me laugh that. There was a very particular way he said, naughty. Which really, really...
Which none of us could do justice.
Tickled me. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just thought it was amazing that of all the stuff going on at every breakdown, that the ref has just decided, right, I'm just gonna pick Derek White and I'm gonna have a chat, just to make it look like I'm trying to do something to, you know, improve the situation in the game. Of course, it doesn't. Nothing comes of that chat. Like, there's no follow up in terms of, like, improving discipline or anything like that. Mm. It's just sort of like, yes, this has to be done. You know, yes, we're aware of how shit this all is, but oh well.
I've got to look, I'm going to get reviewed for my performance. I've got to be seen to doing something.
Exactly, yeah.
There's no ref mic on him, so he can probably just say that to Derek White. Like, I just want to, you know.
White's not arguing at any point. He's not trying to, like, display his point. It's like he's sort of nodding along, like, yes, this is something that has to happen.
I understand.
Yeah.
Like the infamous Phil Bennett team talk, where he went back to his forwards and just said, don't get caught, rather than stop cheating. Big that vibes. He's probably just said that to Derek White, I don't want to catch you again, but keep doing it.
So when, at the start of the game, Scott Hastings goes off, they replace him with Richard Cram, who comes on for his international debut as a fly half. And I think him and Wiley were sort of alternating who was playing fly half, who was playing centre. But Richard Cram sort of goes sort of 10 minutes without touching the ball in his first cap of international rugby, which, you know, as a fly half is quite disappointing. You know, you want to get your hands on the ball early, you want to get involved. And then comes a point where Scotland have just got into the 22 and the moment is coming. Scotland have won their set piece and Cram is there lined up like, right, okay, I'm going to get my first touch of international rugby. And you know what I want to do? I want to do something absolutely glorious here. I'm going to not worry about what the people outside me are doing. No, I want to focus on myself. I want to do something amazing, something magical on my first touch. Like, I've just been given a golden towel by Mr. Adam Jenkins himself, who probably isn't born yet. I want to do something amazing. I'm going to score a drop goal. Except his drop goal, it leaves the ground, in fairness. It does leave the floor. It goes... So he's probably stood 15 metres from the touchline, and I would say it goes perfectly straight.
Yeah. Yeah. It gets to about the height of the crossbar.
Yes.
And goes, yeah, perfectly straight over the 15-metre line. It's massive, massive first-touch syndrome.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And, like, look, I'm not saying I blame him, but we can all agree that that was the only reason he did it, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, first touch, yeah.
I ended this game chief of the Crammy fan club. I think just absolutely... Just wanted to be a part of everything. I felt like just really had the time of his life out there.
I love that his second touch, he gets the ball just inside zone 22, kicks it about 3 metres, and Bill McLaren says, yes, he's typically calm and collected, is Cram. So, mate, he's just shanked a kick.
Can I read you Richard Cram's Wikipedia page?
Yes.
So, oh my God, is that Crammy fan club soundbite going to come back to haunt me?
It's going to live with you. It's going to live with you. Going to have it printed on some towels. So this is rugby union, the section under rugby union career for Richard Cram. He played for Harlequins, New Line. He moved to London Scottish, New Line. He then played for Gosforth, New Line. He played for the Anglo-Scots district in the Scottish Inter-District Championship.
Is this a children's book?
He played for Scotland B twice. He went on to make his full senior international debut in the 1987 Rugby World Cup group stage against Romania. He made 4 appearances in total for Scotland. He went on the 1988 Scotland tour for Zimbabwe with a full caps not awarded. But I love the slow structure of, yeah, as you say, it sounds like a children's book. He played for Harlequins. He moved to London Scottish. He then played for Gosforth.
We will check back tomorrow and it would say, Adam Jenkins likes him.
Do you want another fun fact about Richard Cramp?
Yes.
He was the coach of Newcastle when they first turned professional in 1985.
That's cool.
So, I don't know, he might have ever seen young Johnny Wilkinson coming through. He might have been his kind of mentor. I don't know that for certain, but I know he was coaching at Newcastle. He was a former fly half coaching at Newcastle when Wilkinson was coming through the academy.
And hey, so, we know he's heard of drop goals.
I think you should go all in here and say that 100% he was Johnny Wilkinson's mentor and chief inspiration.
And the sole reason.
Yeah. He was the reason that Johnny Wilkinson got up in the morning all those days and practiced his drop kicking, and he really committed to the art form of the drop goal and the goal kick. And really, it is entirely down to former Scotland midfielder Richard Cramp that England won the 2003 World Cup. We can say this absolutely for certain, that Richard Cramp, who played for Harlequins, he then moved to London, Scotland, he then played for Gosford, that he was the only reason Johnny Wilkinson had a successful rugby career.
I think in 2003, Richard Cramp, watching that ball go over, had a tear in his eye as he thought back to 1987 and his first touch in international rugby, and thought, this is where it's led. Yeah. That was what it was for.
He thought about that missed drop goal and thought it was worth it.
I had to miss that drop goal so that Wilkinson could get this.
Hey, yes. We both kicked completely straight. We kicked it at the same angle.
Yeah. Maybe he'd had some kind of like visitation telling him that he would be responsible for a legendary World Cup drop goal. And he thought in 1987 that his win against Romania would be that legendary drop goal. And then he realised that he had to pass on that baton to someone else.
He missed that drop goal. But, oh no, of course I'm not the chosen one. We're 9-0 up. Of course, that makes sense. It's going to be later on down the line. And that's okay.
It's going to be so later on down the line. It's going to be a different player for a different country.
Who's getting paid.
In a completely different era of the sport. But... yeah. I think that should be his Wikipedia page.
should we just on air now just revamp
just
his Wikipedia
to,
page?
So amateur, here we are, his rugby career. He later coached at Newcastle, where he was the sole inspiration and key mentor for
that's
Johnny
multiple clauses in one sentence
Wilkinson.
There, Robert.
Who's Robert? I'm going to tag it so it tagged onto Johnny Wilkinson's page.
You really need to break up these sentences and make them way more digestible.
No. I've got this problem now that I've been doing the video so long, I write solely for my voice box every sentence I write. I'll just change it to where he led Virginia Castle, where he was the key mentor for Johnny Wilkinson.
Okay.
And then if they need a source, link back to this podcast.
Yes,
that's a great idea. That is such a great way to drive traffic through the Crammy fan club, who will all... like, look, we know what the Crammy fan club are like. They check back on that Wikipedia page daily, don't they? And they're always checking it as somebody updated it. And it's going to be like, notification squad will all be in the group chat tomorrow saying, lads, the Crammy Wikipedia page has been updated. Let's check this shit out. And then they're going to do it. And they'll go, there's a source. And then we're going to have billions and billions of listens come as a result. Genius.
We've cornered the Crammy market.
It's already been removed.
No.
Says you made an article, changed an article to the Richard Cramp, but didn't provide a source. I've removed it for you now. If you'd like to include a citation and a reliable source and re-edit, please do so.
Dude, I'll do that on Sunday when this episode goes up.
Yeah.
I have got a screenshot of exactly what you wrote, so it's all there. I have it already.
God, editing the Wikipedia page so quickly, you'd think it's Sean Holly editing his own page.
Oh, man. Should we get back into rugby?
Sure, if you want to.
One try in. We've been here for ages.
You say this like we're doing this every week.
Yeah, that's true. So John Jeffrey scores his first of many tries.
Mm.
And it turns out the try is assisted by a tight head that Scotland have in the squad called Waisali Serevi, who picks the ball up, like does like a kind of mini goose step around somebody and throws the world's most ambitious offload that goes to hand. And yeah,
what a moment. I think this is the best moment by any prop in this tournament so far.
Yeah, so it is Noddy Rowan himself.
Noddy Rowan, right? So Romania have been completely dominant in the scrum. They win winning penalties, winning balls against the head. And out of nowhere, Scotland suddenly blast them on one, knock the ball right out, win the scrum against the head.
Ball
recovered. Yeah, there's a brief carry by Paxton and Murray.
Yeah.
And then Noddy Hoan comes in at...
Noddy Hoan? Who's Noddy Hoan?
Big ears came along as well. Nori Rowan.
Hey, make way for Nori.
I've got Noddy Hoan written in my notes. I did just read that verbatim. Nori Rowan comes and picks and goes, throws a little dummy, makes a little goose step, darts right through, makes a proper bullock where he's shaking off tacklers. As Bill McLaren says later of Matt Duncan, ripping himself out of tackles, which I think is just a wonderful turn of phrase.
Mm.
Yeah, burst through, and right as Ion, the fullback, is coming across to make the tackle, he throws his, incredibly ambitious offload over his shoulder, the slightest glance to Finlay Calder, who is there perfectly to take it. Scotland then offload a bunch more and score. It's like, it's a glorious try, and it's a phenomenal moment of rugbying from a prop, like completely burrowing through it, like it's the tunnels under Edinburgh.
The amount of times we have seen like wingers and scrummers or whatever going for offloads like that, and it's just not worked in this World Cup, and for that to actually stick was like genuinely, I couldn't believe it on the third replay. 40-meter
bullock and a beautiful offload. Having won the scrum against the head, what more can you ask for from a player?
Phenomenal.
Tyke Furlong knows nothing.
A classic Irish hate coming back into the year.
Oh, I love it. Matt Duncan then scores a try.
Yeah.
So
lovely grubber by Alan Tate.
Yeah. After, you know, some good hands from Hastings. Tate himself then scores, kind of gets the return assist from Duncan himself, which is always a nice poetic thing when two players assist each other within a couple of minutes of each other. I always enjoy that.
Very close friends. What role Alan Tate's on? Like, these are his first three caps.
Yeah.
And he's scored constantly. And he's involved in everything.
Yeah, he's been brilliant.
He's having a hell of a turnout.
Yeah. So Scotland win the turnover, go wide. Duncan kind of steps inside and jinks around a little bit. And then has that thing where the opposition is so convinced that this winger is going to try and dummy it and go himself. Mm. And no, he gives the pass and times it really, really well for Tate to slide in the corner.
Mm. Like Campese we talked about in a previous episode. The confidence of being able to throw that pass.
Mm.
Romania have a couple of attacks during this period. And I have three things noted down, right? One is beautiful by Ion. He throws this like really lovely dummy and darts through from the base where he only like faints slightly with the ball rather than properly throwing like James Hook theatrical dummy or like Kaylee Powell at the minute, who I don't know how would you describe the Kaylee Powell dummy?
You use the word incredulous to describe it, which I think is a very good word for it, but just like, I don't get how anybody has ever bought that dummy, let alone every single game she plays. And like, I love it, but it's not like she's ever going to pass it. And if she did, just let her, because it's going to touch.
She generally dummies to a player that isn't there, and people keep falling for it. Like, I did watch Bristol playing the Premier 15s a few weeks ago, and the first thing I saw when I turned over was her throwing that dummy.
Yeah, I've been there a couple of weeks ago when they played Gloucester. Exactly the same. Yeah.
So Romania also, right, I'm just going to read this note out, but this tactic for Romania of crossfield kicks with nobody chasing really isn't working.
It reaches a point where Bill McLaren starts referring to every kick they do as a crossfield, just because this, like, they have the same strategy for every kick, which is just punt it somewhere away from where the 10 is stood and nobody chase it. And so if every kick is approached the same, they all start to look the same. And so you start calling them under the same umbrella term of crossfield, even if it's straight in front of you. Bill McLaren's going like, oh, that's intended probably as a crossfield.
It's just excellent work. And the other thing I've written down is Sandchild! Romania have a Sandchild!
Yes. Yes, they do.
Sounds like something from Dune. But Romania,
it did take me a moment to know what you meant. Yes.
They have a child who brings on sand.
And is made of sand as well.
Yeah. He's like from Spider-Man. He's the child, yeah. Sandman's kid.
Yeah, he is. That's genuine. Well, no, it's Sandman as a kid.
Sorry, yes.
So that kid grows up to become Sandman. Yeah.
When he was Sand Boy.
Yeah, he was Sand Boy back then, yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, this was just after Metallica wrote that song about his father.
Mm.
So the Sandman that they're referring to in that song was actually the father of the one from Spider-Man.
It's like Donkey Kong. It's like who we now refer to as Donkey Kong. It's the grandson of the Donkey Kong from the game Donkey Kong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And or like there's like Sandman as one great fictional character, Donkey Kong another, Adam Beard is another one. Mm. Like you've got his father, the S&C coach, another great fictional character who I love. Great. Okay. So yeah, they've got Sand Child. Adam, any thoughts on having on the existence of Sand Children?
Sorry, I was trying to come up with a link, doing some really quick Googling. Flint Marco, the real life name of Sandman. And I was trying to think, Marco sounds kind of Eastern European. It's not quite Romanian, unfortunately. But I feel like it could be.
Well, they've got Alexandru Marie.
If it was Marcu, maybe.
Alexandru Marie.
Would you say it was a typo?
Yeah, his real name is Flint Marco, and he's a Romanian sand boy.
That's the clip we're going to pull out and have warned you. He's a Romanian sand boy.
Jotting down in my man of the match section, Flint Marco, the Romanian sand boy.
I just believe that's an establishment that Lawrence Delalio regulates. He doesn't regulate, he just goes there often.
Romanian sand boy. There we go. Anyway, John Jeffrey scores a try, doesn't he? Where it's basically the worst try in the history of the World Cup so far that's not a penalty try. And hey, I'm grateful that it wasn't.
So the ball spills out, as Adam mentioned earlier, ball spills out the side of the scrum. John Jeffrey picks it up and scores.
And the thing is, he looks confused as he scores. Like, he almost looks like he feels bad. Because, like, if someone scores a try like that in training, you think, like, oh, come on, you're just being boring. Like, let's play a little bit. And he almost looks like he feels sorry for the Romanians that he scored that first phase.
So, Marcel Todea, who is the only Romanian in shot, who is kind of jogging across getting the ball, kind of full on goes, no, stop, come back. Just like watch him Zim pick it up and score. He could have dived on that ball, or he could have tried to tackle Jeffrey, but he just doesn't.
I mean, that's the seemingly every Romanian player that doesn't have the ball. It doesn't matter whether the team is attacking or defending. It's more just okay. When they get the ball, it's run, it's step, it's kick, it's do something. You know, it's exciting. And then just whenever the other 14 players or 15, if they're in defence, it's just like, oh no, well. Like as if that Jeffrey's try was like, oh, that was inevitable. That was always going to happen. Just... Nothing we could have done to stop that. Not like, you know, it's very much the attitude. If it was professional rugby, I'd say it was unacceptable. But it's amateur rugby, so it's beautiful.
A very clear distinction. I love it.
I like that their only tactic without the ball is let the Constantine brothers punch someone.
Yeah, truly.
And when they're not doing that this game, when they're having a quieter game, it feels less notable. Feels like maybe that's why they capitulated in defence as much as they did. You know, having perhaps stood up a little more against France. Nope. I say that they conceded the same number of points against France and Scotland.
But yeah. they do score shortly after this, just before half time. They're the last try before half time. And I'm not going to lie, there's not much to say about it.
Well, is this the first try from a proper maul, as we think of them nowadays in the
Rugby
World Cup?
True. That is true, actually. A line out maul, isn't it?
Sucked. It was so modern and boring.
I know what you mean. It's a try that, the sort of try that we can like take for granted, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is cool because that shows it was a good try.
There have been tries from players getting held up in tackles and then driving over the lines and all in this World Cup, right? I believe, but I don't think we've had a try, and we've had the try that Constantine himself, Was it Constantine or was it one of the other...
Something like that, yeah.
One of the other Romanians scored where they dived over the line, having just kind of caught it from a line out and then fell over the line. I think it happened a couple of times. When there wasn't more necessary. I think this is the first time that a team has thrown the ball into a line out expecting to form a maul.
Yeah.
And then they managed to form it around and drive them over.
A deliberate maul try, yeah.
The first deliberate maul try in the Rugby World Cup.
In, I suppose in the 80s it feels like, if you think like the famous Wales 13-man maul against New Zealand, where it was one of those things where the coach had had an idea. They were losing the match. They thought, let's try it and at least get a score.
Yeah.
It felt like a normal driving maul off a line out was like the equivalent of that in the 80s.
Yes.
Like, oh, this is just some crazy idea a coach has had to like set up a maul directly from a line out. Let's just give it a go and see if it's worth bothering.
Somehow Scott Williams still comes up at the top with the ball.
Yeah.
I think that is very much how it felt, but also as you say, it felt slightly boring. But because I have this jotted down for Jeffrey's second try, but 50% of tries in this World Cup feel like flukes. It feel like teams just randomly passing, throwing, kicking the ball. And there is a distinction between the passing and throwing. Not every pass given is a pass. Some of them are just thrown. Some of them are just them throwing it in this World Cup. It feels like 50% of them, they're just trying stuff in the hope it might work. They're not thinking, this is how I break down the defence or get around them, or even do individually.
Really amazing how commonplace what people call now like the basketball pass is. Not even when not under pressure.
Usually you see
it now from maybe a tall second row or back row or something, like Seb Davis is usually the one I go to, one-handed kind of basketball pass. You know, two-man tackle, you sort of reach over them and throw it back. Under no pressure whatsoever, the amount of basketball passes, just sort of deciding not to pass normally and instead just sort of lob it over the top in a general direction.
I think that actually brings us nicely on to... We'll skip half-time, because Romania's second try in this game comes directly from that. So Dumitru, who's come off the bench, number 8 for Romania, breaks away from a scrum and just carries the ball one-handed the whole time. And that's it's a really good try, actually, because that's what draws people in. And I recently wrote an article about this, about the fact that on Thomas Williams, and the fact that Thomas Williams always carries the ball one-handed is what draws so many people into him in open play, because it always convinces people that he's going to run himself when actually he's got the ability to offload one-handed and so on. And there's a sort of distinct few players in the world who are really, really good at that. But what he does there is, he runs with the ball one-handed and just convinces everybody he's going to run himself. And he just kind of like offloads over the top to Romania's fastest womanizer in Tuada, who scores.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very simple finish for him. He's just got to dolly down in the corner.
Yeah, and he could have finished himself, Dumitru.
Yeah, but he's right to give the pass, I think.
He is, so yeah.
100% he turns like an 80% try into a 100% try.
Yeah.
Yeah, really lovely work, really lovely use of a scrum going forward. And then, as you said, great use of his own attribute, I guess, to make the most of that, the space that was available on the field.
Yeah.
And create the try. Yeah, a bit of a kind of rally from Romania out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Romania then shortly afterwards run this really beautiful move, this kind of like faux 11 pattern, similar to the Jacob Stockdale try against New Zealand.
I literally have that written down, the Jacob Stockdale try against New Zealand. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where he chips it over. But before that, when they do the... So for anybody not aware, the play in simple terms, like maybe they hit to midfield like they're going to go for a crash. Then they have someone running kind of like a faux switch where they're quite deep. So they receive the ball, but to distribute back to the way it came. So if it comes from a line out, they're attacking the touchline where the line out was set up, but they convince the opposition they're going to hit it in midfield first. Does that make sense?
Yeah, exactly. So it's going back towards the wing. The only difference here, right, is in 2018 when Ireland ran it and when they ran it before in the 2015 World Cup against Romania.
Yes.
Against Romania, fittingly, actually. Romania. Sand boys. So back when they ran it then, the defence followed them and had some sort of organisation. Whereas at the time, one Scottish player flew up to try and make a hat tackle. Otherwise, the entire team just waited on what would be the game line. And so it meant that they just were stood there when Romania finished doing all their fancy bullshit and just tackled them. And look, defence have come a long way and most of that is for the better. But every now and again, there is a benefit to just standing still and waiting for the opposition to be ready and run into you.
Because most of these modern moves are designed with good defence in mind.
Yeah. Like, every now and again.
It's really interesting, actually. So I hope that nobody that I ever play against listens to this, but there's a move that we used to run with my team where it was, again, like a great example of it is Jacob Stockdale again scored against England with this, where it hits at the midfield and our second phase, you run it so one player gets it, like the hooker, for example, and then throws the ball back on the inside. A two-phase move, and that sends the 13 straight through the middle and they dance around the fullback and score. At first team level, it always works because the defences are really good and trying to organise everything. At second team level, doesn't work quite as well because you often get like fat, lazy midfielders just lurking around the edges of the ruck, which is a really interesting distinction. So looking at kind of the difference between like good defences and this level at 1987.
So what we're saying is the 1987 was actually better than the modern deck.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's the golden age of rugby. It's the, those are the glory
days. Have we come round to becoming Games Gone Soft? Adam, can you put us in our place, please?
I mean, I would. But at the same time, there is a nice simplicity to the game, I suppose.
Mm.
In that, I feel like if I go back to when I first started, like really getting into rugby, one of the things that I loved about it is that I felt like a score could come from anywhere because I didn't really know what was going on. Yeah. I didn't know how defenses worked and things like that. And the more I learned about the game, the modern game in particular, and how things were set up from rucks and how attacks have to manipulate defences in a certain way, the less and less I felt like, oh, a try can come from anywhere. Mm. And the more you sort of then become kind of like, well, I'm not going to be able to expect anything for the next sort of, for this passage of play, however long it lasts, because there's no way they can score from this position.
Yeah.
Yeah,
in this match, I never had that concern that, oh, you know, Scotland or Romania are kind of stuck in their own half here, and the other team have lined up really well, and they're going to have to kick for territory or something. There's you have that kind of bringing it back to the idea where it sort of feels a bit like football, in the fact that there's much less of a set defense involved, that it feels like a bit more free for random shit to happen.
Yeah.
Which on a superficial level is exciting, which is why I think like kind of Sevens is gets its kind of like excitement from. But on a sort of a more deeper level of like loving the sport, there's no real depth there to enjoy other than the fancy passes and the good runs that come out of luck, essentially.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I suppose I get why people have these kind of rose-tinted glasses about 80s rugby and 70s rugby, because you do remember those parts of it. What you don't remember is the fact that everything around it was had to be shit to allow that to happen.
Yes. And I think that's the interesting kind of distinction is that there have been some really lovely tries and really lovely individual passages in this tournament and in this game as well, in particular. But when you go back to this level of rugby, to back to 1987 rugby, the only thing that's interesting was the scoring, right? Whereas you look at modern rugby and I find so much of it interesting and enticing and draws me in, you know, and I find like great passage defence are really exciting nowadays. You know, you get
and like great kicking battles and stuff. Yeah.
Which is something I think is underexplained. A lot of people disagree with, but I think that's only because
and probably because it used to be so shit.
Yeah.
So people assume that it still is. Yeah.
And you look at stuff like there's one between Wales and France, and there's one between England and France, which I've covered in videos and stuff. But like, if that was covered properly, and you had commentators talking us through what decisions were being made by the individual fullbacks and tens and players involved in those kicking. And also, I hold like kicking battles should be shown from a camera behind the goal line.
Maybe pointing this out. It's a really good point. Yeah.
Like the it's just it makes them so much more interesting because you can see what's face and it looks like a tactical decision as well. That's just like something that's my opinion. I will kind of die on that hill and try and force it through.
Yeah.
I don't shout it that often. But I think there's so much more about the game that is really exciting now through those introductions. You know, like you don't have the passages where, you know, that Wales Ireland, one of the most exciting passages of rugby I've ever had was Wales Ireland 2015, when Wales defended 40 odd phases of Ireland attacking.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah. Johnny Sexton diving over the top. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that kind of thing couldn't have happened in 1997.
No.
And that adds to the game.
You know, great moment of drama. The crowd were all really behind. Yeah.
I mean, the Six Nations channel itself made a highlight video out of it.
Yeah.
Out of a passage of defense.
Yeah.
You know, that's
brilliant.
It's you wouldn't get that from pre-professional rugby because it just didn't exist.
A moment that sticks with me, and I know that Wales lost this game, but last year when we played South Africa in the autumn, there was one moment where Johnny McNichol booted the ball downfield and been defending for absolutely ages. And like it was satisfying enough winning the turnover, but that was more out of relief. Johnny McNichol boots the ball downfield, then on first phase, Ellis Jenkins wins a turnover penalty, and the crowd absolutely erupted. And I can remember, Robbie, we watched the game together, and we both got up and just hugged like we'd scored a try, like the winning try. It felt amazing.
It's often those are the moments that get me up most.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. There's great serotonin in Ellis Jenkins' breakdown penalty, man.
He keeps doing it.
Yeah.
As you'd know well. Yeah.
Dylan Lewis is the new Ellis Jenkins, but yeah.
Of course. With the handlebar moustache, though, does that mean when Pivac's going to inexplicably hate him for no reason? He's going to bear the brunt of one loss that was knocked down to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, but as I said, I think there's more depth to what works. And something I've been thinking about the last couple of days, because I stayed in an Airbnb recently, and the guy running it was a rugby fan. Old school, like played in like the 80s and 90s.
Was it Richard Cram?
It was Richard Cram, yeah. And he told me all about Johnny Wilkinson and gave me a great first-hand source for the Wikipedia page. So that is what I'm going to source in that video. So, yeah, and he was saying that he thinks rugby should go down to 12 a side because there's just not enough space now, which is, you know, I suppose an interesting point from things. But I thought about it a bit over the last few days, and I do think it's that point that maybe there isn't enough space for individual breakaway tries, but A, they still happen, right? You look at Harlequins last year and you look at every game's got individual moments where things break out other than maybe the odd World Cup semi-final type game.
Sure. Yeah.
At which point you kind of don't want that, you know, you've kind of too much has waited on things.
Yeah.
And I kind of love that. I kind of love the weight and drama that comes with big World Cup matches.
But you still have it like the, you know, Lions test last year had moments where it's like Cheslin Colby's the only player in the world who could do that thing that he's just done.
Yeah.
You'd have those moments.
Yeah. I mean, that Lions tour is a bad example.
But you know what I mean, though? Like the highest intensity rugby matches.
Yeah. I think the game has changed a lot, and I think it is less open, and I can understand why highlights reels might be less exciting, but I think games as a whole are vastly
loads
more
better.
Interesting.
Yeah. The concentration of good rugby is infinitely better, and it's not even a debate. Like, yeah.
And to be honest, the rugby players are going to, or the style of rugby players, I suppose, chosen by coaches are going to adapt to that sort of, the changing sort of scape of defence, where... There was a point in which the way to beat defenders was to have massive wingers.
Yeah. Mm.
And now that's sort of less, and there's more of a, like, pure straight line pace is now very much in fashion with wingers now, because that's the way to find breaks and things like that. And it's always going to be able to adapt. And I think if you keep changing it, to the point, you're not going to allow that time for players to adapt to that, to the way rugby is now.
Yeah.
Because it will. Coaches are more intelligent than you think, I think, is one thing. And they know exactly how the game works. And they know how to exploit. There's always going to be ways to exploit defence.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's going to change over time,
naturally,
because defense coaches are always going to find a way to counter that. It's just one of those things.
Yeah.
But I think you've got to let rugby change itself, I think, rather than...
I 100% agree with you.
Yeah.
I think what you say about wingers and back three players is really interesting, because Robbie and I have had this discussion a lot before about kind of the swinging between wingers and fullbacks and kind of how those two roles change. And like, it was the thing that kind of the small nippy Shane Williams style player in the was the winger. Then it became the fullback. Now it's become the winger again, like all within probably 5-6 years.
Interesting thing that we've talked about this in the past, both on the channel and in person, I think maybe on the podcast
as
well, that there's been a trend lately for very big fullbacks. You look at the likes of Freddie Stewart, And like Stuart Hogg has bulked up an awful lot in the last couple
massively,
of years.
Massively, yeah, yeah.
Players like that have become a fashion. And yeah. I was talking to a friend of the pod, Connor of Wimbledon Rugby.
Yes, that yeah. Same day,
and he said he's pretty convinced that's starting to swing back. And by the World Cup, it will swing back to being nippy guys.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, like because of the way kicking has changed. Yeah. Actually, because more players are kicking in field and looking to force you backwards and that kind of, you know, France
oh,
style,
interesting.
He thinks the trend is going to be very much focusing on like Henry Arundel and kind of players who are far more steppy and so on in order to counter that kicking.
It makes you think that might be why Eddie Jones put Fred Stewart on the wing on that last Six yeah. Nations game. And, put
and
third
why he started playing, dropping Marcus Smith into the backfield.
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, man. I didn't even consider that. Man, I mean, Eddie Jones is very smart. So is Connor. Fair play. Yeah. We have rambled a lot there. And I think productively. But we've got another John Jeffrey try to talk about.
Oh, that's just... It's just always going to be the case. We could talk for 6 hours. You'd be like, well, there's another John Jeffrey try.
Yeah, we're not quite run out of them yet.
He breaks the record for most tries by a Scottish forward in this game.
Yeah, the record being one. no, but I literally have written down Jeffrey hat-trick, don't know what happens. Yeah. So you guys, I'm going to give this to you guys.
He goes up to 8 tries for Scotland in this game. The previous record was 6. So he smashes that record, which is probably now belongs to Ross Ford. I tried to look this up very briefly, but there's not an organised list now that ESPN Scrum's disappeared.
Well, Dave Cherry's got 5, hasn't he? George Turner must have similar.
Mate, Dave Cherry could break this record that was being much talked about by Bill McLaren.
Just saying. Yeah, Dave Cherry's the GOAT.
If you want to stay on records, I mean, Gavin Hastings scored so many points that Bill McLaren couldn't keep up.
Yes, he loses count of how many points he scored.
Oh, yeah, by the way, he's broken a world record for points scored in a match.
He goes like, well, I think it's at least the most points scored by somebody from Hoyk or Glasgow or Scotland or the world.
Oh, yeah, we missed a conversion earlier. Yeah, he's done it.
Like, I really enjoy him trying not to lose count and constantly going back on himself and so on. It's really fun listening to him doing calculations, even when he doesn't know what he's saying.
So when I was trying to look up the record for points, whether it's Scotland points, tally, and everything still stands, I came across a football match from 1986, so around this time, which finished 37-0. Is the highest score in a professional football match ever by a team that didn't involve one team throwing the game. Because there were two scores higher than it. In both cases, the team were protesting and deliberately conceded their own goals and deliberately wanted the opposition to score. And it finished like 100 plus. But the scoreline is disputed because the referee counted 37 goals, but the PA for the team that scored the goals counted 35. So they split the difference to 36 and submitted that.
That's incredible. I would have loved it if they've recorded it as like team A 36.5, team B nil.
I mean, that's got to just be an attitude that goes. We're talking about the difference between sort of amateur and professional rugby.
Mm.
But, you know, you're saying that it's like a professional football match. Is it just an 80s thing versus now? Like, it doesn't matter whether they were getting paid or not. It's just one of those things where, like, sports was just a kind of a thing that everyone generally agreed on was going to happen one way. And you sort of feel like with refereeing and rugby, like I mentioned earlier, it just kind of, you can give a penalty at any point if you feel like it. Nobody would really particularly disagree. If you can't agree on the score, you kind of come to a middle ground. Like there's no like, I don't know. I want to say professionalism, but
it all feels sillier and floatier, doesn't it? And like they accept this is a kind of daft game. Mm. Like they've still hung on to the game thing rather than the professional elite performance aspect.
It feels like, you know, a primary school sports day where they don't keep count.
Yeah, it does a bit, which is a crazy thing to say about a World Cup.
And right down to the fact they don't have the scoreboard on screen. So every try feels kind of more inconsequential.
Yeah. It's quite difficult to keep up with who's winning half the time.
Especially when the teams aren't playing, like you mentioned with Romania going for goal.
Yeah,
despite being 21 points down or whatever.
Every time someone scores, it feels like the first score of the game, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's
So, as you say, Adam Hastings scores two tries. There's one intercept, which is a brilliant read, goes great the distance.
Yeah.
The other one is...
One of those that looks disastrous in slow motion as he's going for it. You're kind of, your heart's in your mouth for the Romanian because you can just see him steaming up in the way the player probably can't as they throw the interception pass.
The other one, brilliant try, brilliant finish, where he gets the ball around the halfway line, chips for himself, kind of hacks it along the floor and just about managed to dive on it in time just before Pilowski, the winger, does for Romania. Fantastic finish.
That was an odd one because it felt like for every second, even down to the millisecond up to when that ball gets touched, that Romania have it. It's going to be a defensive touchdown.
Yeah.
And then somehow, like even watching it from the reverse angle, I kept sort of playing back and watching it over again, how Scotland managed to score that. Because it just felt like it was constantly going in the wrong direction. And the only thing I could conclude was it looked like the Romanian player going back dove for it, but forgot to put his hands on it. So it just looks like he sort of dolphin dives on it in a way. Yeah, very confusing, very weird try. Perfectly suited to the game.
So Takalo scores another try. So that it's just a kind of simple 8-9-11 move on the blind side.
Really
from the
lovely final offload though.
Yeah,
like the final pass is kind of very subtle.
It is
very good.
Yeah.
And Romania take another shot from the halfway line.
Yes, they do. To narrow the scores from to 22-43. And so there's a point. So we're about 1 hour and 37 minutes into the game where I'm just going to read out what I have in my notes because it's extremely chaotic. Who's the old kilted man on crutches? Oh, hey, Romania have scored. How come these offloads are all going hand today? Is this on Rugby Challenge where they turn up the offload chance slider? Because suddenly, just like everyone's throwing these equally ambitious offloads to other games, just they happen to be going to hand.
I was wondering whether that was actually happening. I was just being lulled into a false sense of security by Bill McLaren reassuring me.
Yeah, maybe that is what it is. I don't know, but I also have no idea who the old kilted man on crutches is. But I was too busy writing about that to notice the Romanian try, so I don't know what happened with that. I didn't bother watching
that
back.
Romanian try, really lovely final pass. They score, and that's pretty much the last play. It's the end of the game, isn't it?
Yeah, I
think
so.
A minute after that, maybe at most.
Yeah, I think that's the end of the game. Yeah.
Full time goes. Kids rush onto the pitch looking for Gavin Hastings autographs. And unlike the bloody All Blacks and their bloody respect they have and rugby values, Gavin Hastings actually signs the kids' autographs. So much so that a very glamorous woman walks up to him and just waits on his shoulder, like very, very close, and almost leaning on his shoulder. And he just completely ignores her in order to sign kids' autographs instead. And she's waiting to flirt with Gavin Hastings, no doubt. Like she looks.
World record breaker out of Gavin Hastings.
Yep. And Gavin Hastings is just signing the kids' autographs. That's good rugby values for you. The beat's just different. Values.
So there's a lot of an interesting kind of ambling about segment after the game where a lot of players are swapping shirts and just doing loads of really good rugby values things like sweeping the sheds, and talking to dogs and so on. But there's a point where there's a few players just kind of walking up and down the tunnel and then you can see somebody asks something to Douglas Wiley, who is stood there in the tunnel, and he just kind of looks up at him and goes, holds his shirt, kind of puffs it out and goes, 10, and then takes his shirt off. So clearly, Demetrio Alexandru approached him in the tunnel and said, "Hey, mate, sorry, what number are you?" And then asked to swap shirts with him, not knowing whether or not that was his opposite number because he didn't recognise him from the game they just played.
That tells you everything, doesn't it? About the fact we haven't mentioned the Scottish fly half in the game they won by a huge margin.
Yeah, yeah. But I just find that really funny that, like, the, you know, Romanian 10 didn't know who he was, but also wanted to swap shirts with him just as a token gesture. He just wanted a Scotland jersey. Either that or he wanted to give out the gift that is the very glamorous Romanian jersey.
I mean, it is excellent. Hastings and I would also say hello, but don't swap shirts. And Bill McLaren says it's a great sporting moment.
Yes.
Which I believe brings us to the end of the game, but I do want to very quickly, it's time for the Romanian leaving party. Very quickly, we do Man of the Match and Dick of the Day, very, very quickly, let's hurry through this.
Yeah.
Romanian, there we are.
Eurovision was last week.
Best Romanian Hits Worldwide, 2015 album. Let's go with Baga 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 Bine.
That's just what I was hoping you would play.
Valdult de la Barge.
Yeah, Romania, they certainly played in this World Cup, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I think they were largely agreed to be quite disappointing for what people were expecting from them in this tournament.
Yeah, they should have lost that game to Zimbabwe. Yeah, I was fuming that they didn't. I mean, the best players in the tournament for them, probably there's the Constantine brothers for non-rugby-related reasons.
Yes. I think the most memorable player for them, as far as I'm concerned, is Stefan Constantine. I think he really stands out.
I think Marcel Tuada stands out for being a complete, like, womanizer and dickhead. And, of course, Christian Raducanu for many reasons, some of which to do with rugby. But I still, somehow, despite all of those, would, if I was picking a dick of the tournament for them, give it to Liviu Hodorka for his performance against Zimbabwe.
I mean, for me, if I'm picking a man of the tournament and dick of the tournament, I'm picking them both as Stefan Constantine.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
And Adam, anything you want to add about Romania?
I mean, I think you summed it up perfectly when you said they were there.
Yeah.
Beautiful. That was one of the best parties I've ever been to. Also, one of the only parties I've ever been to.
So, dick of the day at the match.
Yes.
Should we start with man of the match? Will, do you want to start?
Okay. Oh, it was quite difficult picking a man of the match here, I thought, because, like, you get to the second half and you start thinking it's obviously Gavin Hastings because he's scoring billions of points. But also John Jeffrey scored a hat-trick. And also, we've spent all day talking about how much we love Bill McLaren. So again, I just want to give him a man of the match. Mm-hmm. And I'm very tempted to do that. But just for sheer laughs, I'm going to give it to Colin Deans for his inspired team talk before the game. I think he was quite good. He was extremely understated. He wasn't, I will admit right now, he wasn't as good as Hastings or Jeffrey, but I'm picking this and I just want that as a vibe selection. And also I anticipate that you guys are going to pick Hastings and Jeffrey. So I just don't want to, I don't want to be bland.
Okay. Adam, do you want to give us yours?
Crammy.
Oh, yes.
So... I'm glad Will didn't go for that really obvious choice of man of the match there. Man of many talents.
Which Johnny Wilkinson knows very, very well.
Yes.
And I mean, so the obvious choice is, again, Gavin Hastings, because he really breaks the world record for points. But look, honestly, the guy who I think contributes the most to this game is Bill McLaren.
Yeah.
Look, Gavin Hastings should be man of the match, probably if I was only picking rugby players. But we never limited that. We never said that.
I'm now really regretting my choice. So I kind of want to change it.
It's too late.
Oh, no.
It's too late. It's too late. Your choice is Colin Deans for no goddamn reason at all.
I literally think I saw him about 3 times in this game, and I've admitted that's on air. And what he did was good.
Best thing is, I nominated him for Scotland-France as well, so he's level with Serge Blanco. He's level with Serge Blanco, Glenn Webb, Patrice Lebon, and Super Boot Corridor Adua.
Oh,
for
man.
Second place on player of the tournament to Fabio the dog at the minute.
Oh, that means he's joined with Timothy the dog. I can't believe I've done this.
So, should we do Dick of the Day?
Yeah, sure. So, who have I got written down for Dick of the Day? I mean, it's, I think, compulsory that I have to have Scott Hastings written down for pulling his hammy in the first minute.
Yeah, okay.
Even though I really do feel for him. It's like, it's an automatic qualification. But I have to give it to Douglas Wiley because he made a business decision on a scrum half. There's a point where Paraskeev runs at him and he steps out the way. And it's like, mate, you are bigger than him. You should nail him. And instead he steps out the way scared. And it's like, oh, come on, man.
That is an absolute crime. So, I mean, I think it's hard to look beyond the first 5 minutes of Parashev's game, where he takes a quick tap from a penalty they've just been given, runs into his forwards and gets penalised for crossing, for blocking, obstruction. And then immediately when they regather the ball from the scrum, which they're completely dominant in, he box kicks straight to the opposition forward who goes on to score a hat-trick and creates the opening try. And I think that kind of perfect 5 minutes makes Mireshev Parashev, the Romanian captain, my dick of the day.
I'm sorry, did none of us give Garen Hastings man of the match? He scored the fucking world record number of points. Did none of us give him man of the match? We've got three of us here. None of us gave him man of the match. He literally scored more points than anyone has in the highest level of rugby. And not even that. Look, it's not even like the reason why we didn't give him man of the match is because his flanker scored a hat trick, which was rare at this point, and also broke a record. We've just neglected to give him man of the match for no fucking reason.
The thing is, Will, you gave the worst justification.
I did! And now I've lost my fucking mind!
Adam, who's your dick of the day?
I'm a bit torn between two Scottish players. I mean, there's Matt Duncan for his disgusting slide tackle on Ion.
Yeah.
But that didn't really cost his team anything.
Mm.
So I'm going to say Derek White for being the only player to be called out by the referee by name at any point during the match.
Yes. What do you have to do to get caught in this game? Derek White doesn't know. The referee doesn't know, but it happened. Okay. Does that bring us to an end? Do we have anything else to add?
No, I need to lie down.
I'll tell you what, I do have one thing. Bloody Alex Andrew, the 10, who takes a short-range kick for Romania, kicks the ball like he hates it. He kicks it in spite. He looks furious with the ball when he kicks it. And I enjoyed that energy, and I want to take it forwards into absolutely nothing. Adam, thank you very much for joining us. Where can people find you? Where can people find your stuff? Find the Dummy Runner, find Line Break, everything else.
Yeah, just the Dummy Runner on Twitter and Line Break Rugby I'm a part of as well. And apparently I need to set up a towel company. So look out for that. Thank you very much for having me on.
No, thank you.
Thanks for coming back, man. We wanted to have you on this 87 series. We thought you'd be the perfect energy for it. So thanks, man.
I don't know whether to take that as a compliment or an insult. So
let me tell you categorically, it's an insult.
Thank you very much.
And well, thank you as ever. Thank you to everybody for listening all the way through our almost 2 hours on Scotland v Romania. Please join us next time when the game we're covering will be France 70, Zimbabwe 12.
We're going to talk about that for probably an hour and a half, an hour and three quarters.
Good luck, guys.
We've chosen this. I have things that is to one be of the, doing.
That's one of the funniest score lines I've ever heard. Oh, man.
Why are we doing this?
There's got to be some kind of underlying psychological issue that you're that's responsible for this, surely.
Suddenly coming to bear. So
I don't say this as an insult, but nobody asked for this.
Nobody at all. No one ever wanted.
Especially even if they did ask for like a World Cup retrospective. I mean, choosing 2011 and 1987 over like 95 or 2007 is surely it's a choice. And yeah, I'm both impressed and I pity you. So
I'm mostly just disgusted. Why are we doing this? I'm going after this to have my eyes tested, and I'm just going to ask them to poke them out. Oh, right. I wonder if once I've had my eyes tested and I can see properly, I'll realise how shit this World Cup is.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, Adam, thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you to everyone for listening. And we'll see you next time for France 70, Zimbabwe 12. Jesus Christ.
Gavin Hastings.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.